That tonight, for the next three Wednesday nights, what I want to do is we finished the series on Esther, but for the next three Wednesday nights, I want us to look at Ravi Zacharias. He is one of my favorites that I love to listen to, but he grew up in Hinduism, and I don't know if you know a lot about the Hindu religion, but most scholars say that there are 330 million deities in the Hindu religion. 330 million deities that they worship and pray to and all of that. So the reason I want us to do this is because he tells about how he was converted to Christianity growing up in India. And So I hope you will be here for this. It's a great study of, and it will be a video series for the next three Wednesday nights, and then we'll look at what he talks about from one week to the next. All right? So here we have.
Today on the John Ankerberg Show, Dr. Ravi Zacharias answers the skeptics. Ravi grew up in India, where his ancestors belonged to the highest caste of Hindu priests. But one day, he heard the words of Jesus Christ and became a Christian. He has gone on to become one of the most brilliant Christian apologists in the world, traveling to more than 70 countries and speaking at the most prestigious universities, notably Harvard, Princeton, Dartmouth, Johns Hopkins, and Oxford University. He addressed the writers of the Peace Accord in South Africa and military officers at the Lenin Military Academy and the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow. Three times he's been invited to speak at the annual prayer breakfast at the United Nations in New York. And he has addressed the national prayer breakfast in the seats of government in Ottawa, Canada, and London, England, and spoken at the CIA in Washington, D.C. Join us today for the special edition of the John Ankerberg Show.
Welcome to our program. I'm John Ankerberg. Thanks for joining me. Possibly a friend has called you and invited you to watch our program today and hear our amazing guest. If so, I want to welcome you and say I don't think you're going to be disappointed in what you hear. My guest is the brilliant Christian apologist, Ravi Zacharias, who has traveled to more than 70 countries around the world, speaking at the most prestigious universities, answering students' questions about life's toughest questions. And he does it both logically and lovingly. He also speaks to government leaders in different parts of the world. And three times he has spoken at the United Nations in New York, their annual prayer breakfast, which marks the beginning of the UN General Assembly each year. And this broadcast, folks, is being watched in 206 countries and territories. It's being translated into many languages. And in the weeks to come, I've asked Ravi to answer questions from students. First of all, we'll spend a week with those in the Far East, then we're going to move to the Middle East, then another week from those in Europe, and then from students in America. And so I think you're going to enjoy that. But today I want you to get to know this man. He was born in Chennai, India. And Ravi, our world is confused. People are searching for answers, and they can't seem to find anything that matters. And you were a confused young man yourself. Take us back to Chennai. And you did not know the clear teachings of Jesus Christ. How did it all come about that you became a believer and follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, first of all, it's good to be with you, John. Known you over many years and just a delight to have our friendship. Yes, you're right. I think confusion is probably systemic in our world today, and it's not particular to any one culture, no matter where I go. In fact, the greatest percentage of our audiences is really among the young, mm-hmm. be it universities or high schools or whatever, because that's a questioning stage in life. And there's a Chinese proverb that says, if you want to know what water is, don't ask the fish. When you're so immersed in something, oftentimes you really don't even think of a counter perspective, or you don't think of questioning what your environment is about. But the interesting thing is you may be immersed externally in something, but internally you cannot run away from what keeps on haunting you. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you're right, born in the city of Chennai, India, used to be called Madras at that time, but a few years ago was changed to Chennai, Bombay was changed to Mumbai. I have to keep up with all of this. Raised in that southern city, my mother was born and raised in Chennai. My dad came from deeper south in the state of Kerala, and they met in Chennai and were married there. So my dad spoke Malayalam, my mother spoke Tamil. I was raised in Delhi and spoke Hindi. I often say I can speak Hindi and Tamil. Malayalam, I only knew the scolding words my dad used, mm-hmm. so I don't use them in public. Mm-hmm. But Chennai was my home city till I was very young, 3 or 4, and then moved to Delhi. But the thing is, John, people don't realize that India is probably the most religious country in the world. People are pursuing answers through ceremony, through historical pursuit of tradition, and all that comes along with religion. Technically speaking, Hindu scholars will say there are 330 million deities in the pantheon of Hinduism. Now, only a handful of them are really followed very diligently by people in India. But in that culture, having had the privilege of an ancestry that went back to the highest caste of the Hindu priesthood, which was the Nambudris. My dad was from Kerala, my mom from Chennai, as I said. But I never really thought seriously about religious things. Why? I was immersed in the struggle to perform academically. India is a very competitive culture in academics. If you don't make it in your studies, you're going to go nowhere. So the pressure is on you from every side.
Big time, the pressure is on students there.
Yeah, and not just enough to pass. It had to be high. You had to be right at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to make it. Cricket was in my blood. I played cricket and tennis. I loved the sports field, hated the academic side of it. And ultimately, it got me into serious trouble with my father. I wasn't going to make it. And that confusion of pursuit and the need for acceptance. Another thing about India is it's a shame-oriented culture. If you don't do that well, then you're shamed into trying to be successful. The highest rate of suicides in India is immediately after the examination results are posted in the newspapers all over the country. Kids are jumping off buildings, pouring kerosene on themselves and burning themselves. This, my closest friend did this to himself. So that was really the culture within which I was born and raised and struggled. My brothers and sisters were all doing well. Mm-hmm. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was sort of the failure of the family, and that finally got to me.
Yeah, I've been to Mumbai. I'm going back to Calcutta. And I watched people very sincerely following whichever religion they were practicing. So they were sincere, but they're still confused. They still don't have the answer. They're still searching. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes. The major religions in India, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism, you've got a touch of Baha'ism, all of that. Christianity forms a small percentage of it. And people, you know, often think that sort of Christianity is this exclusivist worldview. No, no, not true. All of them are exclusivistic. Every one of them is exclusivistic. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been founded. They are founded for a purpose, certainly with certain distinctives. And in the search for answers, I just ended up with none whatsoever. And the emptiness, the loneliness, and the failure in school, I didn't have a single Christian friend, by the way. They were all, majority of them from the Hindu worldview, which places such great value and respect for family and all of that. So that's the way I was raised. Mm-hmm. But the emptiness came in with no answers, only questions. Tradition, tradition, tradition. You followed it. I knew this was not going to get me anywhere, and finally I attempted to take my own life.
Yeah, talk about that. How did you do that?
Well, you know, for many years I couldn't, John, to be honest with you. As long as my dad and mom were alive, it was very embarrassing for them, till my father in his latter years, point blank, asked my wife to talk about it and then asked me. It was it's again the same thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to admit how low they had become in life. I just want to assure the listener, it had nothing to do with any psychological debilitation, no such issues with drugs or whatever like that. It was just a search for meaning. I wanted to put life together, and it wasn't coming together for me. So I was going to my classes in college and went into the science lab out there, saw some chemicals, took these plastic bags. I didn't even know what all they said, except I took the ones that was marked poison, mm-hmm. brought it back to my home, put it in a glass of water early one morning. Everybody was out of the house. Went into the restroom and just, it started to froth immediately, effervesce. So I just stirred it with a teaspoon and gulped the thing down. I used to tell my story in the early days by saying, unfortunately, but a doctor corrected me once. He said, you better say fortunately. It was very salty, and my system began to reject it. And there I was holding on to the sink as the moisture was coming out of my body. I collapsed on my knees. I shouted for help. The servant in the house heard me screaming. Nobody else was there. He came. I don't know whether he broke the door down, pushed it down. I don't remember exactly, but he saw me in that pitiful state, put me into a taxi and rushed me to a hospital. And when I was fully composed of my senses again, all I knew was needles were in my arm because of the dehydration, my mother and father by my side, and the ultimate desolation of knowing you didn't even know how to live, now you didn't know how to die. That was the crossing road moment for me in asking questions more seriously than I had been asking.
But a man came into your room and did what?
Well, this is the amazing thing to me. That's why I believe in sort of divine appointments. I wasn't looking for anybody to come. In fact, I still don't know how they let him get that past that
right.
much, probably because he said he was a minister. And he brought a little red New Testament and wanted to read it to me. And my mother said he couldn't. I was in critical condition. So he opened it to the 14th chapter of John. And ironically, it's Jesus talking to Thomas, the first person who ever went to India with the gospel. Mm-hmm. And he was reaching the Nambudris, by the way, mm-hmm. my very ancestors from centuries ago. And in that 14th chapter of John, as Jesus was saying, because I live, you shall live also. I grasped onto that verse and said, Jesus, if you are offering me life like I have never had it, I want that life from you. That was the turning point for me. I never really prayed any meaningful prayer. And I invited Jesus Christ, the author of life, to give me the life that he alone could give, aged 17. And the Bible handed over to my mother. I couldn't hold it because, as I said, the dehydration had set in. So my mother, in her heavy accent, reading this to me, I prayed the prayer. And that was the beginning of a journey that has now continued with utter delight and perpetual novelty. Yes, twists and turns and ups and downs, but when you have the map of God in your own heart, you walk with him hand in hand.
My guest is Ravi Zacharias, a brilliant Christian apologist that has spoken on probably more university campuses around the world than anybody I know. And you were asked to come to Harvard and present lectures mm-hmm. on a very tough question: can man live without God? And out of those lectures, a book came. But take me back and answer the question, can man live without God?
Yes, it was a very memorable time for me, John. Early 90s, when the first Veritas Forum was held. Now they're held all over the country in various universities. And the subject was given to me, can man live without God? From the quotation by Will Durant, he said, the greatest question of our time is not going to be North versus South, East versus West, communism versus capitalism, but the greatest question of our time is going to be, can man live without God? So that the last phrase is what I took and put into the title of my lectures. I gave two lectures there, sponsored by various groups, philosophical societies, the Christian groups, and so on. And the venue was the Harvard Law School. And I do remember two things about it distinctly, that it was held on the weekend of the Harvard-Yale football game. So they were nervous that what kind of a turnout we were going to draw. And number two, it was the first time I was on my feet in about 2 weeks. I had been in Scotland doing some research on David Livingstone, injured my back, herniated my disc. My body was really off kilter. I'd been laid up in bed in Glasgow for 5 days, came back, one of my teammates flew in to bring me back, and I lay in bed all that time till the day I had to fly out to Boston and do this. Those two memories are so vivid. I didn't know how it was going to go. But that was the question and is the question. There are two ways to answer it. Theoretically, yes, people can live as if God doesn't exist. Atheists, agnostics, anti-theists, at least for the most part, do. Logically, it is impossible, especially if you want to make a moral pronouncement on any issue. This was the struggle Jean-Paul Sartre had. This was ultimately the struggle Anthony Flew had, as you well know. This incoherence of trying to build a worldview on the fundamental questions of life, it cannot be done logically or coherently. Yes, existentially, people may try to wing it somehow live day to day. But if you want to live a coherent life and present answers to the haunting questions with which you live, it is impossible to live without God. I think that was Durant's challenge. Are we going to live as if he doesn't exist? And if that happens, what kind of a chaotic world are we going to face? And as Nietzsche said, the 20th century would become the bloodiest century in history because of the popularization of the death of God type thing. And indeed it was more bloody than the previous 19 centuries put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it interesting that Nietzsche's writings influenced Hitler. Hitler gave them to Stalin and to Mussolini. And you can tell what happened in all three of those nations.
Yeah, this is, if you read Paul Johnson's book, Modern Times, he tells this story. He talks about these three demagogues of the mid-1900s there in Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini. And the irony of it was Stalin at one time was preparing to go into the ministry, lost his faith in God. Hitler, of course, wanted to build the super race, the Uberman, the stronger man that he wanted to build to take over. And these ideas of living without God became popular. Nietzsche, ironically too, son of a pastor, and both of his grandfathers were in the ministry. And he said, when we realize God has died in the 19th century, a kind of madness will break out. The last 13 years of his own life, he spent moving between sanity and insanity, oftentimes in silence for weeks. But here's the parable he gave. He said, have you not heard of that madman who took a lantern and went into the city saying, I'm looking for God, I'm looking for God. He excited considerable laughter. People standing there looked at him, thought he was just a maniac himself. And then he said, where has God gone? Have we lost him? Has he gone on a journey or a voyage? And these questions. But the thing I like about Nietzsche is he was honest about the implications of his conclusion. Mm-hmm. Modern philosophers don't like to take it logically to where it goes. Nietzsche was honest, and he said things like this, the metaphors that he used. Who gave us a sponge to wipe away the horizon? Is there any up or down left? Will lanterns have to be lit in the morning hours? How did we accomplish the greatest of all deeds that humanity has ever accomplished? No horizon left, no point of reference left. He recognized that the death of God meant the death of absolutes and the death of definitions. So here was his question. What games will we need to invent in order to sort of assuage and to bring some kind of satisfaction? So what is he saying? Some type of spirituality is desperately needed, something mystical, something of an absolute nature. How are we going to find all of this now? This to me, John, really, this to me is the greatest question of our time. If God is no longer in the paradigm, where are we going to find the definitions? What point of reference? Nietzsche was right on target. And so he said, two things will happen. The 20th century will become the bloodiest century in history because the 19th century killed God, philosophically he meant, and a universal madness will break out. Need we even probe beyond even the surface to see the data on where we are today in our world? When you look at what happened in the 20th century, Auschwitz and all of that, people don't like to hear these things. They say, you're pulling at extremes. No. G.K. Chesterton put it this way, the tragedy of disbelieving in God is not that a person ends up believing in nothing. Alas, it is much worse. A person may end up believing in anything.
Yeah, and you said there's four struggles. If we eliminate the presence of God from a culture's life or from an individual's life, and the first one that you said, and you've never had anybody that has argued logically to give you a better answer to these questions, these struggles. The first one, if God does not exist, there is no objective point of reference for any moral framework. Explain that.
Well, you know, I'm an Easterner by birth and a Westerner now where I live. I've brought these two cultures into my, and I see the strengths and weaknesses of both. In the Western world, we wonder if there is a God. In the Eastern world, which God to believe in? You know, these tensions mm-hmm. are there. But the reality is, ultimately, we need a moral framework by which to build our lives. In America, we talk about the roots of law. All right, we have the roots of law. We have the trunk of politics. We have the branches of culture, and it spreads out. What's going to hold the roots together? Mm-hmm. It's a moral soil that has to hold the roots together. That's how America, for example, was framed, with order and so on. So where do we turn for a moral point of reference? Even the best-known atheists have admitted that. It's only the popularizers who like to come up with all kinds of solutions, the Sam Harrises and all, who think we can find moral reasoning apart from God, and they just warm up old washed-up theories that don't really make sense. Mackie the Australian said, you know, it's difficult to talk about these things of good and bad unless there is some kind of a theistic framework. He granted that. Kai Nielsen, the Canadian atheist, said, rationally you cannot come to moral decision-making no matter how many facts you bring together. And then he said this fact alone troubles me. Bertrand Russell said that he chose between good and evil the same way he does between yellow and green. He said that to Copleston, and Copleston said, yes, you choose between yellow and green by seeing, don't you? He said, yeah, but how do you choose between good and evil? He said, well, on the basis of feeling. You know, I've often said to my audiences, in some cultures they love their neighbors, in other cultures they eat them. Did Bertrand Russell have a preference? Mm-hmm. By the way, Nietzsche himself said that words have no meanings ultimately. They're in a hall of mirrors reflecting on each other. He said, but I am also too pious to bend my knee at the altar, which is called truth. What was he talking about? The moral implications of what is true. And to me, John, and I know in your life too, I'm raising a family. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a grandfather now. And I look at where the academy is taking our young. Relativism, the absolutization of relativistic way of thinking, it's like having our feet firmly planted in midair. The search for moral absolutes without a transcendent point of reference is an impossibility to have it logically done.
Yeah, we're going to come back to this more next week because these are such important points. But in the 2 minutes that we've got left, let's hook this up to what you were saying happened in your own life. People are searching for meaning. They're searching for answers. And you didn't find it in the world. You didn't find it in just religions. You found it in a person. Talk about that and how this person, Jesus Christ, answers these four struggles that we have that we're going to talk about a little bit more.
You know, when I spoke at the UN, I was asked to speak on the search for absolutes. And I talked about four searches here. We have the search for evil, how to define it, the search for justice, how to define love, and when can we legitimately forgive? Evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. And they were listening intently. I said, now I want to ask you this question. Where in history did these four converge at any one given moment? They converged on a hill called Calvary, in the person of Jesus Christ, in whom perfect righteousness was revealed, in whom the love of God was shown, and who brought justice into focus in the penalty for sin and offered me forgiveness. Nowhere else will you see the convergence of these four realities and the offer of forgiveness and grace. I found it in Jesus Christ. And to my listening audience, I say the same thing. If you look to him, speak to him, pray to him, he offers you his love and forgiveness and his redemption.
Yeah. Folks, this is great stuff. And if you are thinking about these things, would like to have more information, you can go to our website where there's a place for you to think about praying to Jesus Christ, a prayer something like Ravi prayed way back when. But there's maybe more ground that needs to be covered before you do that. So I just hope that you'll stick with us right now. And in these weeks to come, we're going to talk about man's search for God and the answers that are there, but some people don't seem to be able to find them. We're going to ask Ravi to guide us through this confusion, the whirlwind that is out there, and to give you specific examples next week on Can Man Live Without God? So I hope that you'll join us then.
Well, I don't know about you, but I really enjoy Ravi Zacharias. I've heard him many times, he is a brilliant, brilliant person, and it's just where we are in our world today, relativism versus objective truth. It's either subjective, that everybody just does that which is right in their own eyes, or else there is an absolute truth, and that comes from, as he said, a transcendent reference point, and that is in Jesus Christ and Christ alone. In these next few weeks, and there are two more programs on this, and then I have three other programs where he's talking with students and questions that kids are asking about all of these kinds of things that he's talking about. It's where we are in our world today, is that so many people, they have no reference point, no standard by which to make moral decisions, and so everything in our world has become very subjective. If it's okay in your eyes, then it's okay. And he will argue the point that no, it's not okay. There has to be a moral reference point, and it converged at Calvary through Jesus Christ. Thank you for being here tonight. God bless you. Would you stand as we pray together?